Well, we're in the third week of our new message series for the new year that we're calling The Chosen. We're looking at choices. You make choices every day about a lot of things. But the central message of this series is that the most important decisions about your life aren't completely up to you. God has chosen you for His purposes and not the other way around. In the first week of the series, 2 weeks ago, we said that God has chosen you to do something every day for Him. And that thing that He has chosen you to do is to reveal His love in the world, especially in places where God's love is missing or in short supply. Showing God's love to other people is something we're all supposed to do every day. But as we pointed out last week, sometimes God chooses certain people to do something very specific for Him at a very specific time. Something important, perhaps unexpected, and maybe even life-changing. And when that happens, we said that you will probably be reluctant to do it. In fact, almost every person who has ever done something great and important for God never thought they would be doing it, and perhaps never wanted to do it. But as we also said last week, if you just take that first step, you'll find that in the end, that thing that God was calling you to do, it was something you could never, in the end, have imagined not doing. And perhaps the only thing you really ever wanted to do with your life. Now, in today's episode, this third week of the series, we're going to be looking at how God wants us to live as His chosen people. He has chosen us, but how should we live as His chosen people? And we learn that in one of the most famous passages in the entire Bible. Jesus teaches those He has chosen to follow Him how they are to live. It was an important moment because He was just beginning His public ministry. And as you probably know, first impressions are lasting impressions. Notice what Jesus does. He doesn't give them a list of do's and don'ts. Instead, He rolls out a series of 9 short statements called Beatitudes, each of which is like a guide for living a fortunate, happy, and blessed life. Now, it may surprise you to learn that the Beatitudes were not invented by Jesus. They actually came from a very common literary form used in many different ancient cultures of that day. They were used to describe people who were in privileged, even enviable situations. For example, there are no less than 45 Beatitudes in the Old Testament. Here's one example. Happy is he who dwells with a sensible wife. I'd turn that around and actually say, happier is she who dwells with a sensible husband. Far harder to find. Anyway, you could also find Beatitudes in Greek and Egyptian literature. They were all over the place. Jesus did not invent them. So think about it. In the most important public appearance of His life, in His first ever TED Talk, Jesus chose to use a very ordinary way of teaching people. But when you look at the Beatitudes closely, you will find that they were far from ordinary. Jesus' Beatitudes challenged the common understanding of what it takes to be happy. And it turns out, according to Jesus, it's not people who are self-reliant, self-confident, self-satisfied, and self-centered who are truly blessed. It's not the wealthy, the well-educated, the well-born who are the happiest. It's the poor and the humble, the grieving, the meek, and those who are persecuted. The Beatitudes Jesus espoused are much more than some conventional, run-of-the-mill set of generalized principles for living a good and moral life. In fact, hidden within these familiar lines is the true formula for happiness. And believe me when I tell you, when Jesus told this formula to his disciples, it was a bombshell. In the very last beatitude, Jesus makes this shocking statement. He says, "Blessed are you when they insult you and persecute you and utter every kind of evil against you falsely because of me." Now, what was extraordinary about that statement, what was shocking about that statement, was not the fact that his followers should endure suffering and persecution. All the prophets and the rabbis said as much. But what they said was that people should endure persecution and suffering out of obedience to God and his law. But what Jesus says is that they should endure persecution and suffering because of him. It's a subtle but enormous difference. Jesus teaches loyalty not only to God's law, but to himself specifically. This would have been absolute blasphemy and the worst kind of sacrilege were Jesus not who he said he was. What Jesus was doing in these Beatitudes was nothing short of establishing a new community of followers centered around him as the long-awaited Messiah and the Son of God. Right from the beginning, he was forming a movement of people who were chosen to be devoted to him. And the people in this movement were expected to live differently because of their relationship with him. They were expected to live in peace with one another, without the level of conflict and division that we see in the world all around us. And if you're like me, I think you see it as well, that there is conflict everywhere in the world. And it seems to have ramped up to an unprecedented, almost intolerable level as of late. For example, I'm sure that you have been praying, as I have been, for all the families impacted by the senseless shootings over the last couple of weeks in Los Angeles and right here in Half Moon Bay. And we sit in horror that these events have become almost commonplace. And when you look out at the political landscape, the ideologies and the media empires that have been built up around those ideologies have become so polarized that we just demonize, mock, and cancel anyone who disagrees. And with a deeply contentious presidential election on the horizon, I fear that these divisions, these conflicts, are only going to get worse. And sadly, the political and cultural disagreements prevalent in wider society out there have crept into the life of the church at large. What used to be polite differences and respectfully held differing attitudes towards church teachings or the style of music or an approach to worship have now become the source of deep divisions in the church. And the root of all that conflict, whether it's out there or in here, the root of all that conflict, as I see it, is arrogance. We are so sure of our opinions, aren't we? So right in our judgments that we sometimes have a hard time leaving any room for anyone else's point of view. The judgments we make about the superiority of our own deeply held attitudes are in fact the very weapons that divide us. The situation we're in today is precisely what St. Paul addresses in the second reading today, his first letter to the Corinthians. Those were people who lived in a place called Corinth. Let me tell you about Corinth. It was a prominent international city about 100 miles outside of Athens. It was strategically located between the Adriatic and the Aegean Seas. Corinth, therefore, became a corridor of commercial trade. And as is often the case with port cities, it developed a reputation for indulgence. The expression to live like a Corinthian suggested a life of pleasure. That Paul was able to establish one of the very first Christian communities in Corinth, of all places, was in itself a minor miracle. However, from the very start, there were problems in the Corinthian church, and they were bad problems. There was disunity as people fought with one another, forming factions and cliques. These factions and cliques arrogantly promoted their members as more prominent, more important, more valuable than others in the community. It was hard to be a Christian in Corinth precisely because there was so much conflict. So Paul writes to address these problems and clean up the mess that was developing. Here's what he says right in the very first chapter of that letter. We heard it tonight. He says, "Consider your own calling, brothers and sisters. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. In fact, the majority of Christians at the time were ordinary people, members of the lower classes, and some even slaves. They were commoners, not members of high society. They did not come from aristocracy. So why, Paul wondered, were they acting all high and mighty with each other?" So Paul reminds them of this. Take a look. He says, "God chose the foolish of the world to shame the wise. And God chose the weak of the world to shame the strong. And God chose the lowly and despised of the world, those who are count for nothing, to reduce to nothing those who are something, so that no human being might boast before God." The conflicts experienced by the Corinthians, like all conflicts, were rooted in arrogance. Each person thought themselves wise by their own estimation, powerful in their intellect. But Paul wants to uproot that arrogance, and he points out that God is not impressed by the knowledge of the intelligentsia. He is not impressed with the power of the social elite. In fact, Paul says, God prefers the poor, the bottom rung of society. He makes somebodies out of nobodies, Paul says, and nobodies out of people who think they are somebody. He reminds his readers that all true wisdom comes from God, which is why, whether you're poor or rich, Paul says, whoever boasts should boast in the Lord. Paul's advice to not think of ourselves as wise and powerful is precisely what Jesus teaches in the Beatitudes. And whenever we experience turmoil and conflict, it is because we arrogantly boast of something other than God. I will go on record as saying that the church must be a sanctuary from the destructive and dehumanizing values of arrogance and self-promotion that lead to turmoil and conflict in the first place. The church needs to be a safe harbor in the midst of that storm. It should be a refuge and a relief from the polarization experienced everywhere else we go. Church needs to be the one place where everyone truly is welcome and each person can feel comfortable discovering and growing in their faith without judgment. A good example of that is a man named Jim. Jim is our technology team leader. On any given weekend, you will find Jim up in the balcony. He's up there tonight. Hello, Jim. You can wave to him if you feel like it. Hi, Jim. He's up there waving to you. He's given me permission to tell this story about him. He runs our sound, our graphics, our cameras, and our lights. And if you're watching us online, Jim is the one that's responsible for all the beautiful camera work. After all, I'm not bragging here, and I'm not overstating the case. Jim is among a handful of the best recording engineers in the world. Now, you may have already encountered Jim as he's walking around here doing his duties before or after Mass. And if you have, you know he's got a very gentle demeanor and a big smile. No matter what goes wrong with the technology, and every weekend something does go wrong, Jim always handles it with patience and optimism. But what you might not know is that when I first met Jim, he was a hardened religious cynic. He was among many in our world who believe that church is boring and bad. He had no interest in faith and no time for church. Jim's been helping me now for almost 5 years. And I don't know if he's just slowly getting brainwashed by my homilies or what. But a while back, we were having major tech issues and I was really worried. And Jim turns to me and he said, "Father Roger, don't worry. God's got this." I was shocked. A couple of months later, when I was anxious about something else, he said, "Father Roger, you just have to have a little faith." And then recently, when I was frustrated by yet another issue, you're detecting a common theme here, I get frustrated a lot, Jim pulled out my personal favorite, "Father Roger, what would Jesus do?" And I kid you not, last night after Mass, Jim comes up to me and he says, "Father Roger, you know, I've been dealing with this huge problem. I've got 500 eighth graders coming to this campus from all around the Archdiocese next week, and I got to pull out a technology miracle. And I was getting frustrated because I couldn't figure it out. So I went to lunch and I prayed over it, and I got the answer." I don't know what Jim would say about his faith today, but he's here, and he's listening, and he's helping. And last week, as we were walking out after the final Mass, this Mass, and after a very long day, Jim turned to me and he said, "Father Roger, do you know why I like working here so much?" I said, "Jim, I've been dying to know the answer to that question for years." He said, "Because every time I walk out of here, I feel good. And I know I've done something really important." Wherever Jim is on his faith journey, like a lot of people, when he comes to Mass here, he feels good and he knows it's important. Jim has found a home in our welcoming and loving community. A church that is truly a safe harbor from all the chaos and conflict that's everywhere around us. I want to finish with a quote by a businessman named John Shedd. He's the founder of Marshall Fields and the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago. And he once said, "A ship in the harbor is safe, but that's not what ships are built for." Yes, we need to be in church. Yes, we need the safe harbor of the church. It's important. But what we were built for, what we were chosen to do, is to go out into the world where the waters are a little rougher. The world measures greatness in terms of wealth, power, and fame. No wonder there's so much conflict. But you are chosen for a different kind of greatness. You are chosen to be part of a great movement whose members, though imperfect, at least try to move together according to the unconventional values of Christ. And we choose to do that, to at least try, because we recognize that there really is only one foundation of truth, only one source of wisdom, only one cause of greatness. And it's not us.